You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 22nd, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Cara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Let me out.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks. Hey, Jay, you okay?
I've had enough.
Just tapping out.
I haven't had every now and then. Yeah. Every now and then, Jay calls me in the morning. He's like, Bob, done.
I'm over it. I'm not so done that I'm willing to go to we're done rally and wear a firearm on my hip. You know, I'm not ready for that.
That's good.
Not there yet.
Not that done.
No, but I'm just getting very I couldn't imagine like being on a 6 month spaceship mission to Mars.
I pretty much guarantee I couldn't do that.
Yeah. VR.
Imagine being in a capsule for 3 months.
I think I could do it, but here's the difference. You'd be could you be in a capsule for 6 months versus being in a capsule for 6 months with your children?
Yeah.
Yeah. The company would matter.
Sure. Oh yeah.
But also I would want VR.
Yeah.
Yeah, VR would
VR,
have to be
AR,
critical.
Absolutely.
It's such a no-brainer, right? I mean, it's an
But even still, I get antsy. I just need the perception of freedom of movement, you know?
Do you guys actually, does your skin actually get a little itchy?
No. Sometimes when it
Jay, you need some cream,
itchy.
Dude.
No, I mean.
You get mentally itchy.
I'm definitely getting like, you know, that antsy, like itchy thing going on where I'm like, oh my God, I just want to get out. I just want to, you know.
Oh, wow, yeah. Dude.
Want to shed your skin.
Yeah, you're a few months ahead of me.
Well, but keep this in mind. I have two children in the house.
Two adorable children.
Yes, but no, they're high
That's
energy.
Right.
They are
in close proximity.
Crazy outgoing.
Good euphemism.
Outgoing like nobody's business. You know, they are, the second you turn your back, they're doing something, and one out of three times, it's bad. You know what I mean? So it's like
two kids, one out of three, it's one out of six.
Yeah,
okay.
So like
I got
most of the time, you just have to, you can't turn your back on them, you know? Like, and it could be something like they grab an iPad and you don't want them to be playing Minecraft. Okay. You know what I mean? But the next thing could be standing up on a mantle. You know what I mean?
You can't do that.
You're drinking bleach, you know? There's all kinds of things going on over there.
So did you guys hear, I read a news report that more people are getting poisoned at home because of cleaning products.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of my pitches for the week. We got something more interesting. But yeah, it's I think it's what, like 30 or 40% increase in poison control.
I'm sorry, the
calls.
Consumption? Yeah.
No, it's a lot of things. It's like people are getting it's just more poison control calls since we've been in quarantine.
Yeah, people are at home, there's cleaning
people are
products.
Home, yeah. And they're paranoid, so they're like using cleaning products in ways they didn't. Like some of the calls are because somebody would have poured like bleach and vinegar together.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, they're mixing.
Oh, the bleach ammonia.
Yeah, bleach and ammonia. So they're mixing things, or they're consuming them, or they're using them like as hand wash and not realizing that, at a certain point, you're actually going to get poisoned by ingesting these products, whether it's in your mouth or through your skin.
Or maybe it's like that Bugs Bunny episode, Jay. Remember with the two castaways and they look at each other and they see a hamburger and a hot dog?
Okay. I don't know if we're quite there yet.
But this is what we're seeing more generally, that, you know, the public is getting restless and we're starting to see protests against the lockdown. Unfortunately, this is the time when we need calm, competent leadership from the top. You know, we're also starting to see like the emergence of a lot of narratives from certain parts of the media. I wrote on Science-Based Medicine today about the narrative that, hey, this is just a bad flu season and we don't lose our minds every season with the flu. And so that analogy is horrible. It's wrong on many layers.
Yeah.
Just very, very quickly, again, you can read my Science-Based Medicine article for all the details. But let's run the numbers first while we're doing that. So worldwide, 2.6 million cases, 183,894 deaths. And if you look at just completed cases, that puts the death rate at 20%, or the case fatality rate, 20%. So a lot of people are quoting studies showing that that there's a lot more asymptomatic cases out there than we thought, and therefore the mortality rate may be as low as 0.2% or 0.35%, which is, you know, still more than the flu, 2 to 5 times what the flu is, but down, but a lot closer. But that's, I think both ends of that spectrum are very, very deceptive. The actual number is probably somewhere between 3 and 5%. But we, as we said multiple times, we won't know till it's over. We could look back. We're underestimating in many ways. We're overestimating in certain ways. I point out in my article that just by expanding the denominator doesn't reduce the deaths. You know what I mean? It doesn't mean you're less likely to die if you get diagnosed with COVID-19.
Right.
It just means that there's a lot of people who have it that we didn't know had it. It doesn't actually minimize, you know, the mortality and morbidity from this disease. Again, we won't really know until it's over. But again, the big thing that the flu analogy misses is that, a typical flu season, like in the U.S., for example, kills between 12 and 61,000 people. But that's over the course of typically around 6 to 8 months. Right now in the U.S., the last numbers I saw were over 40,000. Total 46,500 as of this recording, but that's over 2 months. And the curve is still trending generally. It's up and down, but it's still trending up. We're
not out of the woods.
It's not going down. You may be flattening in places, whatever, but it's certainly not on the way down yet. And this is overwhelming our resources. You know, we've spoken about the fact that there, in some hospitals in New York, they have 2 patients per ventilator. You know, that's a pretty extreme step. We're running short on PPE. We don't have enough testing to go around. At my university, I haven't been personally called yet, but some of my fellow neurologists have been called to cover medical floors. That's a pretty extreme measure, you know, when you're doing stuff like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're having to rejigger the workforce to try to cover at least, not optimally, but at least reasonably, you know.
Oh, they're pulling last year meds, like they're people who are still in med school are like working as if they're residents now, as if they're, interns now. They've had to accelerate that, and nurses too.
Yeah. So, and this is with extreme physical distancing. Imagine what it would be like if we weren't doing anything.
Yeah.
Right?
Like Sweden.
Well, Sweden's an experiment. You know, people bring that up a lot too. They're doing targeted isolation, not universal isolation. But, you know, it remains to be seen how that's going to work out.
Too soon.
It's too soon to say. And there's indications that it may not be working out well. Yeah, it may not be working out well for them, but we'll see exactly how they compare when all is over. And also, you know, Sweden's not the United States. You know, it's hard to compare country to country.
Yes, but if you compare Scandinavian countries, their curve is skyrocketing.
It's true.
Oh, my God. It looks starting to look so bad. Much worse than any other line in any other country in that area.
Yeah, overall, we can't see this general trend across the world that the countries that had physical distancing earlier and more extreme or have a flatter curve. And those who are late or very soft in their requirements are having more cases. So we can't really, again, there's been a massively wide range of modeling. Like how many deaths would we have had we had no physical distancing? That's like an impossible question to answer because there's so many. It's like, Bob, as you like to say, for a chaotic system, it's extremely sensitive on initial conditions. So the assumptions that you put into the model, because diseases spread exponentially, has a dramatic effect on the outcome. And so it's hard. Right. We'll never really know. But just think about it. I mean, we're approaching 50,000. We're approaching sort of the upper limit of the worst flu season. And we're just still kind of in the early stages of this, you know, maybe getting to the middle of it. And this is just the first wave. There may be more than one wave. Yeah. And this is with all the precautions that we're taking.
Yeah.
Come on. There's no comparison to the flu, unless you want to compare it to the 1918 flu pandemic, which killed 50 million people at least around the world.
Right.
That's the comparison's stupid in two ways. One, this is no flu. This is a lot deadlier, causes a lot more morbidity, overwhelming our medical system a lot more than the flu season. And two, a bad flu season is bad.
Yeah.
So even if you're correct, what are you talking about? Yeah, we're only going to have millions of deaths. That's what a quote unquote bad flu pandemic is like. So it's kind of a dumb narrative, no matter how you look at it. But it's just a way of justifying saying we want to ignore the experts and the scientists and we want to open up the economy before we really should, which also isn't going to work. And economists are saying that. Economists are like, no, if the best thing to do for the economy is to shut down this virus, if you prematurely relax the laws to keep people, you know, for physical distancing, first of all, people aren't necessarily going to listen. Just because the powers that be say, yeah, it's okay for you to risk your life now and go back to work, you think people are going to do it? Well, you know, we don't know how, you know,
some people
statistically,
will.
How that's going to pan out. But it's not going to really get us back to anything resembling normal. It's just really going to, and if that causes a second wave, that hit on the economy will be far worse. So even from an economic point of view, a purely economic point of view, the best thing to do is to aggressively, you know, address this pandemic to minimize it as much as possible.
Well, yeah, and they did post-hoc analyses, at least in the U.S., of different management strategies for the 1918 flu pandemic, and they found that, by and large, economies that stayed shut down longer, like states or cities, major cities, that stayed shut down longer and, you know, had social distancing measures in place for longer, they actually had a better economic recovery.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, we need the discipline to accept short-term pain for long-term benefit. Yeah. And we just got to do it. We got to suck it up, Jay. You know, even though you're stuck in the house with your two adorable children who are driving you crazy, you know, you just...
Well, I am sucking it up. I would never do anything.
I know. I'm just using you as a funny example. But
Steve, as another example of sensitive dependence on initial conditions, I read an article that was talking about China and that there was some evidence, whatever, you know... Who knows if this is absolutely true at this point, but they waited. China apparently waited 6 days. They had solid evidence that there was human transmission going on. And they waited, after they knew that internally, they waited 6 days before they announced it to the world.
Those were big 6 days.
That was the biggest 6 days in this entire mess, because I read that if they had announced it at that point 6 days earlier, that could have whacked off 2/3 to 75% of the ultimate infections that resulted from that, and that's probably the most extreme example of that sensitive dependence conditions in this scenario. Oh my God, 6 days, man! But what made it worse? And you think, and it's hard, you know. You think, oh damn, how could they do that? But you know, I think it's maybe even a little bit worse for the countries afterwards that knew full well what they were dealing with. That information that China didn't have at that time, but they knew full well that what was coming, that this was a potential pandemic and it could be horrific. And other countries delayed similarly as well. So I think there's a lot of blame to go around. It's a lot of blame.
Yeah. So one other quick follow-up, this one about the hydroxychloroquine hubbub. You guys remember this? So there was a new study, a VA retrospective study, so not randomized, but they had three groups. They just looked at their patients retrospectively, those who got hydroxychloroquine for COVID-19, those who got the hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, and those who got nothing, except for all of them getting, of course, the usual standard of care. And they found no benefit from the hydroxychloroquine. However, the death rate in the hydroxychloroquine group was twice that in the nothing group.
Whoa.
It was like 22% versus 11%, but there was no difference in getting going on a ventilator. You know, again, it wasn't randomized. You could say, well, maybe the people who were sicker got the hydroxychloroquine, so it's not the last word. It's not definitive. But as preliminary evidence goes, that's pretty discouraging. The evidence is really moving rapidly against hydroxychloroquine. But again, we won't know for sure until we have a randomized controlled trial.
Right.
I think what we do know for sure is that we shouldn't be publicly promoting
people. Of course not.
That's the scary thing. Like, it's like equal and opposite to the message that is being put out by.
You should only be taking this as part of a clinical trial. That's it.
There you go.
Yep.
But that's not what's happening.
No.
Because of reckless messaging.
There you go.
Jay.
Yes.
Jay, I just sent your family, your kids, a box of noisemakers. It should be arriving tomorrow.
Oh, great.
Horns and
now my
other
dog
things.
Will chew it up, Evan. He'll just
Oh, we're going to talk about the dogs now.
Okay. Oh, puppers.
Maybe next week.
All right, let's move on with some science news. So Jay, I understand that we are experiencing the endless frontier of scientific progress.
No, we're actually not. which is the sad point. So
what?
Yeah, this was, I have never heard of this, and I think you'll find this to be a really, really cool, but ultimately a slightly depressing news story. So the United States has a history of being a leader in science and technology. That's just simply the way that it's been. And it's largely because the government has been pumping in incredible amounts of money into science and scientific research for a very long time. Now, this goes back to 1945, where a document was created by a man named Vannevar Bush, who was the director of the Office of Scientific Research and Development back in 1945. This document was called Science, the Endless Frontier. And inside that document, it was outlined, in short, how incredibly important and significant science is and how much it needs to be woven into the fabric of our culture. And the document actually made some serious headway. Now, since the document's creation, scientists have been able to successfully secure federal funding for their work. It also helped foster communication between the government, industry, and academia. And the concept of American research universities and the National Science Foundation were born out of the writing of this document. So it really had a profound impact. Now, recently, there's been a noticeable decay of the system that had been established after the paper was published. The government research funding has been steadily going down over time, and some scientists need to need the time to invest in projects that could take decades and possibly lead to nothing, right? So in recent years, there's been more of a focus on short-term results because the government wants, you know, the success and the money and the prowess of having, you know, legitimate things that can be turned into useful items and also make money and help the economy. But meanwhile, the government is cutting scientific funding and cutting the scientific advisory panels. And that's really bad. So the reality is that these changes will have a significant effect on the United States' geopolitical standing. Now, I'm not sure. I couldn't research every country and what their standards are or whatever. But, you know, we're talking about the United States because the United States, the technology that the United States has created and does create and is a part of, it is part of a global effort. It is part of the global scientific community. It's not something that is completely restricted to the United States. So on the 75th anniversary of the report, a symposium was organized that included the National Academy of Sciences, the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, and the Kavli Foundation. So at the symposium, all of these companies and organizations and foundations got together, and they discussed scientific research in the United States, past, present, and future. And I think most importantly, they were talking about how to move forward. You know, that's why they wanted to have the symposium, to really try to solve this current problem that they're seeing. So keeping in mind that some of the brightest minds, science and the government and academia and business and philanthropy, all of them were present at this meeting. So people who attended the symposium agreed that the United States needs a long-term federal science plan that should have both a practical and aspirational goal or multiple goals. So the attendees agreed that the level of federal funding was not adequate, right, the current level of funding, and that it takes a lot of time to develop new technology that can find its way into the market. So meaningful ideas that are complex and would take a long time to commercialize are currently being dropped because investors want a faster return on their investment, of course, and they also, you know, don't want their money being tied up in something that takes a really long time. Well, unfortunately, science takes a long time. Now, let me give you an example of one of these lofty goals, a fusion reactor, right? How long have we been working on fusion technology? How much longer will it take? How much money has been put into it? How much of that money has been subsidized by the government? Who will reap the benefits? But I truly believe that we'll get there. It is an engineering problem.
Absolutely.
At this point.
And we're getting closer. I mean, it's tangible. We are getting closer. It's really...
But at its core, Bob, the fusion reactor concept is one of those ideas. First, let's be fair, the fusion reactor idea is legitimate, right? But there were thousands of ideas that seemed just as juicy that ended up being not feasible. The fusion reactor is feasible. But now that we have it in view, we have to look back on the history of the fusion reactor and go, well, all the time and energy and money and promises that were made and everything. And right now, we're just seeing like the potential of it actually coming into being at some point.
Jay, as of right now, I'm looking at a Wired article. The title is Fusion Energy Gets Ready to Shine. Finally. I mean, it's really, the progress is really
palpable. Yeah, but haven't
palpable.
We been reading that for 20 years?
Yeah.
Yeah, but this is Wired.
But you get the point. But the point being...
The thing with fusion, though, is that it's not that whether or not we can make it happen, it's whether or not it's going to be cost effective.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, scalable, cost effective, pragmatic, all those issues, not just the physics.
Yeah, but it's also like cancer research, Steve. It's like people want the big sweeping leaps in technological development, but we've been making baby steps for years. And
there's
a
difference, though. Right. The difference is every baby step you make in cancer research increases survival
people,
a little bit.
Helps people.
When every little advance you make in fusion research doesn't get you anywhere until you cross that threshold where you could make more energy than it costs to put in, and you get more value out than you know, it just be energy effective and cost effective. Until you cross that threshold, all those baby steps don't add up to anything except more money spending on research.
But that's not true, Steve. You know, not completely. And I think there are a lot of technologies get developed, supportive technologies to help
like
make, you know, like make magnetic field manipulation and things like that. You know, plasma containment is not just for fusion reactors. There's lots
of
reasons.
Good point, Jay. That's a good point.
The spinoff argument is complicated because you have to also compare that to, well, what if we spent that money directly
cost,
on research?
Right.
Yeah, there's the opportunity cost. We don't know if it's actually research effective to be doing it through the back door. You know, it's kind of like the space travel arguments, like, oh, all the spinoff technology. Yeah, but what if we spent that money on research? You know?
Yeah, yes. I feel like that's a worthy argument if we're in the babiest stages of technological advancement.
Yeah.
Yeah, like if we're doing basic science for the first time in this field or something, yeah, all sorts of shit is going to spin off that we wouldn't know how to dedicate those funds towards direct research.
But it's also return on investment. If we have a working fusion reactor, like artificial intelligence, put the time, put the effort in, because the payout is going to be gargantuan. It's like making enough ventilators and having enough PPE for a pandemic that may never rise. When it comes, it could be horrific. So you got to be prepared. So it's similar to that. The payout for these technologies is too great to ignore.
But I am wondering if what we're arguing about right now has anything to do with your news item, Jay.
Well, it doesn't, but it's okay. I mean, it is like a microcosm of this idea, though, because people in government are having these discussions and saying, "Is it worth it? Should we do it? What's the point? You know, how much should we be willing to pay something forward in order for it to be of value?"
Sure.
But so just to bring it back to what I was talking about. This idea of investing in these technologies and having it cross into academia and cross into big industry and all of that, it's very similar to the idea of a record label signing 10 bands with only the expectation of one of the bands making money, right? That's what they do. That's what historically they used to do. They'd sign 100 bands and they'd be like, God, if two or three hit, we're golden.
Yeah.
And that's what scientific research is like. There's a lot of scientists out there following rabbit holes, unfortunately, that end up not going really anywhere. But the point is, you have to do that in order to find that piece of gold. You have to be willing to spend money like that in order for us to do things that can, you know, turn into these huge accomplishments. So anyway, so from the year 2000 to 2017, the United States spent 40% less on R&D, right? We had a 40% drop in R&D from 2000 to 2017.
You mean as compared to what, like the net, the GDP of the country? What's the ratio there?
I think it's just raw dollars from the year 2000, from the year 2017, the U.S. is now spending 40% less money on R&D. Conversely, China went from 5% to 25%. And the other thing that the symposium concluded was that the United States no longer is adequately coordinating the connection between academia, industry, and federal research, which is bad, right? Yeah. Because these different groups represent much different intentions and ideas, and they bring different things to the table. But when they work together, and historically in the United States, when they work together, you know, a very important thing can occur, which means much more scientific research and much more latitude for scientific research. So the global competition, though, is a big issue here. One, you actually want it. And two, you don't want just one country dominating. You want multiple countries being able to spend this type of money, and you want them to work in coordination with each other, because we have, you know, like the U.S. sending industry to China helped China tremendously. And then there's been this natural progression of sharing of technology and information and everything. And it should be – we should be moving in that direction. So the problem here is that when one country shrinks away, it has an impact on all the other countries now. It's not siloed like it used to be 60 years ago, 70 years ago when this started. This steady decline that the U.S. is showing, it presents, you know, a real problem because there isn't a quick fix to it, right? You can't just snap your fingers and reallocate 40% of those dollars back into the system. It would take a lot of time. It's going to take the will of a lot of people. And you also, when a country loses its steam, like a perfect example is when President Bush Jr. did not want to have any research done for what? It was the
embryonic stem cells. Yeah.
Yeah, he wanted to drastically limit it.
Presidential lines
in unreasonable ways. Right?
Yeah. So when that happens, you know, or when when organizations that exist are disbanded, like, you know, like the response teams to dealing with viruses like COVID, you can't just snap your fingers and make it all come back when you want it there. It takes time.
Yeah, I think one way to look at it is, you know, we shouldn't think of it as spending money on scientific research. It's investing money in scientific research. So there are certain things that are investments, not spending, and you have to think of them completely differently. And I think that's been the problem in the last, you know, 10, 20 years, is that we're not investing in lots of things the way we should be because, you know, in the name of decreasing, quote unquote, spending. But it's short-sighted. It's very short-sighted. All right, Kara, tell us about these bizarre bacteria.
Ooh,
bizarre bacteria.
So here's a cool thing. These aren't new. They weren't newly discovered. But some of their metabolic activity has been fleshed out. And turns out that what has been kind of theorized as a possibility and even as potentially a strategy for early life on this planet has been found to be in existence in a particular organism called Acetobacterium woodi. And Acetobacterium woodi. Yeah, woodi. I think I'm pronouncing it right.
Wood-eye went right to the police.
Would you say that's woodi or is it woody? I'm going to go with woodi.
Woody?
I'm going to say woodi. So it looks like the genus was named in the 70s. And we've kind of long known that Acetobacterium is a eubacterium that is capable of making acetic acid. And this is through a type of metabolism called anaerobic respiration. So I'm going to back up for a second and talk about like way back to biology class, if you guys remember aerobic versus anaerobic respiration.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Let's hear.
So here we're talking about respiration, which is, you know, producing or taking sugars and generally downstream making cellular energy. And so these are not organisms that make their own food. So we're not talking about, but we're not talking about plants here, right? We're not talking about organisms that make their own food.
No photosynthesis.
Yeah. We're talking about organisms like bacteria, animals, you know, fungi that are going to produce cellular energy. And they're going to do it usually from sugar. That's really usually where it starts. But from kind of these like organic molecules. And ultimately it can happen in an aerobic or an anaerobic environment, right? We're used to aerobic respiration because it's what we do. We breathe. And through breathing, we're able to produce through breathing and eating, collectively, there's a chain of these really interesting metabolic pathways. And ultimately, we end up with energy in the form of ATP, cellular energy. Now, there's other organisms, and you know them because you've worked with them before, that thrive in anaerobic environments, and they will—they don't utilize oxygen in that metabolic pathway. You probably know about them from things like lactic acid and ethanol fermentation. So you've got your organisms that ferment in low to no oxygen environments and produce alcohols. That's how we have the things we drink. And you have the organisms that ferment in low oxygen or no oxygen environments and produce the types of acids that are required for like cheese making, that are required for baking. So we're pretty comfortable with this concept, right? A lot of bacteria is anaerobic. Now what ends up happening oftentimes is that when fermentation takes place in these low to no oxygen environments, there is a byproduct that's produced. That byproduct is hydrogen. And when you produce too much hydrogen, it can actually be toxic to the organism and it shuts down fermentation. And ultimately, that bacteria is going to die if it can't keep fermenting. So they've developed something that you mentioned a second ago, Bob, this idea of symbiosis, but it's a more specific type of symbiosis called syntrophy. And syntrophy is a really, really cool process. It translates to like eating together or, you know, cross feeding. So in syntrophy, you've got these organisms where one species lives off the byproducts of another species and it becomes this symbiotic relationship. And so oftentimes you'll see that with anaerobic bacteria, as they ferment and then they produce hydrogen as a byproduct, there's another organism that actually eats the hydrogen, or at least they live in a hydrogen-rich environment. It helps them with their metabolic processes.
So is that kind of like the human centipede? I forgot I said that.
Gross. I don't know how the human centipede closes. Does it close on itself, or is it an open-ended chain?
No, open.
Okay, then I don't think so. This needs to be a circular.
It's like plants and animals. You know, we exhale CO2, and plants exhale oxygen. Right.
Totally. But imagine it instead of being like in a macro ecology, it's more of a micro ecology.
These
organisms are living within close proximity to each other. And if one of them can't do what it does, the other one's going to die. It's kind of like, remember we talked about corals and then the organisms that live inside of corals. And when the corals start to bleach, the organisms leave and then the coral itself is going to slowly die. And so you're going to see this kind of thing happening a lot of times with anaerobic bacteria. Okay. We got that. That makes sense. But A. woodi is weird and cool because it turns out it can do both. It can either produce the hydrogen as part of its aerobic fermentation process, or it can utilize the hydrogen as part of its respiratory process.
It can control?
So it can switch back and forth.
As needed.
As needed. So not only can it live in an area where there's not enough oxygen and it's going to undergo fermentation and produce a bunch of hydrogen, then it can switch over and live in a hydrogen-rich environment. And we've never...
That's a nice advantage.
It's a huge advantage. And apparently we've never found evidence of that before. It's been theorized. And there are whole organisms that we've theorized to have that capability. But as we haven't been able to study them in such a way to understand how they've worked. And so now... I think researchers are starting to see that maybe the theorized ancient bacteria that probably very likely lived on extraterrestrial meteorites, that probably very possibly lived in these extreme, like they're extremophiles, in these extreme early Earth environments, even some of these archaea early on, they might have been able to switch back and forth. And that metabolic capability would have given them the ability to have an advantage to be able to ultimately evolve.
Karen. In fact, I just assumed when I heard about what this bacterium could do, I just assumed it had to probably be archaea because typically when I think of that, I think of a bizarre metabolism. But this one clearly is not archaea. It's bacteria.
No, it's a gram-positive bacteria.
Yeah, it's bacteria. And that's probably because of the one of the main differences between bacteria and archaea is the cell wall itself. So that's probably – it's clearly a bacteria. But it was still a little surprise because usually I think – oh, crazy metabolism? Got to be archaea because typically they're the more ancient and more wildly diverse extremophile type organisms.
Yeah, and the cool thing is when I actually was reading about this, I decided to read more about Acetobacterium, the actual genus. It's the genus and then the species specifically, woodi. I started to look into it and the first reference that I saw on Microbe Wiki was talking all about the kind of sources of the name Acetobacterium woodi. And I think... it was first found in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, in black sediment. And the name Acetobacterium is acetum, which is vinegar, right? We've heard of acetic acid, and bacterium, because this is an acetogen. It's an anaerobic bacterium. There are aerobic bacteria that do this as well, but this specifically is an anaerobic bacterium that predominantly makes acetic acid as its byproduct. And so it's been well known because it has applications, right? We often think about, we know about bacteria that we can utilize in industry quite a lot. Like that's a big way for us to have done a lot of research on them. And we can utilize that because it's going to be producing acetic acid, which is vinegar. It's pretty interesting, right? So, but this bacterium, as you said, Bob, it's not an archaebacteria, what we used to call archaebacteria, now we call archaea. Yeah. It's a more kind of genetically newer organism, Acetobacterium, or phylogenetically newer, I should say, Acetobacterium. but it has what we think are the key metabolic processes that would have been required in much more phylogenetically older archaea. And it's opening up the reason that one of these write-ups was actually published in Universe Today, which sounds like, why are they writing about bacteria, is because of its astrobiological and capabilities, right? Like, this would be the first direct evidence that bacteria can be more flexible than we even thought. And bacteria are pretty flexible as it is. This could not just talk about the origin of life on Earth, but potentially life on other worlds.
Wow. Yeah, super bacteria. Nice.
So, I don't know. It's super interesting. I always love it when you – it's like – I feel like the answer – if you're a biology student – I feel like I've said this on the show before. If you're a biology student and you have an exam coming up and the question says, this type of organism always does this or never does this, the answer's probably false.
Yep.
It's probably false because there's so many cool exceptions.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Good stuff.
Thank you, Kara.
Mm-hmm.
So I got an interesting question that I did somewhat of a deep dive on, and that is, can UV light kill the coronavirus, kill COVID-19
virus? We talked about this a little, right?
Let me guess. It's complicated.
It's complicated, but you're going to go into it in more detail.
Yeah.
So
I vote yes, it can.
Yeah, the short answer is that, yeah, ultraviolet UV range EM radiation light does have antibacterial and antiviral activity. It's a way of delivering lots of energy, and that could, it's in the range, the range of the spectrum that can actually do damage, right? It could do damage to DNA and RNA.
UVA or UVB?
There's also UVC, which is shorter wavelength, higher energy, really dangerous, right? UVC to your skin. You don't want to get exposed to it.
Yeah, but it says here, Steve, all UVC and some UVB are absorbed by Earth's ozone.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
UVC.
That's why we don't fry.
That's why we don't fry and get cancer. Well, eventually you do, right?
In two seconds.
Yeah, but
without that ozone, we'd be effed.
Yes, we would be effed because the UVC does in seconds what UVA does in hours, right, of sun exposure.
Mm. Right.
It's a lot higher, energy. It's basically anything between like 220 and 280 nanometers, or 200 to 280 is UVC. All right. So the question is, can we exploit this ultraviolet light as a way of killing viruses? And the short answer is, yeah, then we already do it, right? Hospitals do it. Other places do it.
Yeah, we did it in my old lab.
Yeah, you could do it under a hood to, like, I want to just kill everything in this area. Just bombard it with UV light, and it will destroy bacteria and viruses.
Yeah, we had a UV and fungus, too. That was really important to us because we get fungal infections. So we had a UV light in our hood, but we also had an overhead UV light in the clean room part of our lab, and we would run it overnight. But we also had to put in an ozone filter because UV puts off a crap load of ozone, and that's really dangerous to breathe. Yeah. It's like,
You don't want to breathe.
And so you can have these like charcoal filters that you put in next to them so that you can absorb some of that excess ozone.
So are we sterilizing utensils with this? Is that
what you can?
You would sterilize with an autoclave, though, right? Because that's just faster and more.
Yeah, you could also sterilize with heat.
Dalek unit re-initializing.
So, in most labs,
locate, exterminate.
Okay, Bob wins 15-year-old award. In most labs and medical facilities, you're going to sterilize in an autoclave because it's like a pressure cooker. It's heat under pressure.
Yeah.
And it's really hot. Because the problem with UV light is it can't get underneath things.
Mm-hmm.
It's only going to sterilize what it's bombarding.
The surfaces, right.
Straight line, so you'd have to flip it over.
So when it comes to sterilizing things, right, fomites, remember the word fomite, Kara?
Yeah.
So it does work, but because UV light can also be damaging to eyes and to skin, it really should only be used by people who know what they're doing. Right, by people who are trained and are under the proper conditions.
We learned that in that Star Trek episode where Spock had the thing stuck.
Yeah, but you didn't have to throw the whole spectrum at him.
Exactly.
But, and that actually is relevant to the news item that I'm talking about. So
hey!
It turns out, all right, so there's UVA, UVB, and then UVC, which is the higher energy, more damaging. It gets filtered out by the ozone, but you can produce UVC to kill viruses and bacteria in settings, you know, where that are safe and that are controlled, but not with people, right? You don't want to shine it on your skin to disinfect your skin because you're just going to give yourself a massive sunburn in a very short order. So it's dangerous. It'll quote unquote fry you. So
So don't you carry? Can you carry around a UVC flashlight and just shine it on the surface before you touch it?
So you wouldn't want a UVC flashlight. That's like the very definition of hazardous, right?
That's a loaded
gun. I'll
basically.
Be real careful.
You
know, I think it's best in controlled settings. it's really good in hospitals because we have a massive problem with drug resistant, you know, organisms in hospitals. And one of the advantages of using light, just directly transmitting energy to them and breaking them down, is that it's really hard for bacteria or viruses to evolve resistance to it. So it may be, in fact, resistance proof.
You may be accelerating their evolution and they're going to be immune to UVC.
You can't use it inside a body. Once you're infected, it's of no use. And you can't use it you can't expose skin to it. However, a couple years ago, there was a study, although this was in mice, that looked at far UVC. So now we're talking down into the 200 to 220 nanometer range. Or 222 specifically. They used 222 nanometer frequency specifically. And they found that for some reason that frequency does not penetrate the skin very well. So it doesn't really, but it does still interact with viruses and bacteria very well.
So that's the shortest end of the UVC part?
Yeah, it's like far UVC, which is a little bit counterintuitive, but it's just a matter of whatever. There's something in our skin that filters out that frequency. So again, maybe using a specific frequency rather than throwing the whole UV spectrum at it might be able to still kill bacteria and viruses but cause less damage. But this has not been tested in people. Has not been tested in people. It's been tested in mice and it's been tested in aerosolized flu. So it was also found to be effective in aerosolized flu. There's also the method of using these specific frequencies, either even infrared frequencies or other frequencies of light, that just finding ones that that particular bacteria or viruses are particularly sensitive to, or you treat them with a dye that absorbs that frequency. Like you tag them with a dye that absorbs that specific frequency, and then you use that frequency of light to kill the bacteria and the viruses.
Yeah, they do
that
on people, right? They inject the tumor with the dye.
Right, you could do similar idea. That's the state of the science here. This, you know, this is actually a thing. It works, but it's more for industrial hospital, you know, use than your home. Only because of mainly for safety issues. But having said that, there are tons of products you could buy online. Like as you said, Bob, UV flashlights or little boxes that produce UV light. And these have become much more common because of the availability of LED UV lights. Even LED UVC. So then they're being sold basically like, put your cell phone in here or your money clip or whatever, and it will sterilize it for you.
Or your toothbrush. I've seen
Or your toothbrush.
Yeah.
It could work. The thing is, I just don't know because I don't really see any objective scientific studies of specific products. And, you know, so it could be – one question is it doing what it's saying it's doing, right?
Right,
is it just shining a blue light?
You know? How do you verify
So you have to just technically verify that it's doing – it's producing the frequency that it's producing. But otherwise, the thing that I couldn't find on the products that I looked at, they always give the nanometers of the frequency, but not the intensity. And so I wonder, because like the UVC lights that were studied that I talked about cost $1,000. And so can a $50 box you buy on Amazon do the same thing that this $1,000, you know, light is doing?
Sure, but it takes a month.
Well, yeah, I wonder. Well, yeah. But the thing is, if it takes a long time, it doesn't help because the viruses will be dead in 2-3 days no matter what the condition is. The question is, can it accomplish in minutes what would otherwise take hours or days? So it probably does increase the rate at which the viruses break down, but how? But does it function as advertised? Who knows? That's the thing. Because they're very squirrely. They don't come right out and say this is the intensity of the light that's being produced, like the wattage or whatever. Just here's the nanometer. It's a blue light. You put the thing in a box and it works. Yeah. So it could work. I would just like to see specific products tested against specific bacteria and viruses with some actual objective data, not in-house kind of promotional data, but some objective scientific data. So, you know, I think, you know, with these cheap boxes that you buy at home or lights or flashlights or whatever, I just think the jury is still out. So it's plausible, theoretically could work, can't vouch for specific products. And of course, I'm always worried about the false sense of security. It could give people think, oh, I don't have to worry so much about my fomites because I put them in the UV box, for
it's
a short period of time.
Yeah, it's masking all over.
Yeah,
Steve, do you know what I use my UV flashlight for?
Yeah, you have one.
Yeah, go
for it. Of course, I have a UV flashlight.
I know what you use it for.
I use it for UVC. Two uses.
Wait, is it UVC?
No, it's not UVC.
Vampires.
Okay.
No.
Oh, man, you're missing the boat.
But close. Not really. But kind of. I use it when I go camping in the desert to look for scorpions.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Because they glow under UV light, and it's
nice.
Freaking awesome.
You ever see any?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Do you scream? I would scream.
Yeah. No, I love it. So cool. But you're like, wow, that's really close to where I'm sleeping. And then I also use it to see if I did a decent job cleaning up the pee stains from my dog if and when he pees in the house.
Yeah.
Oh,
and you never do.
Yeah, you never do. But you can see like
don't shine
old
that in your bedroom.
Stains. Yeah, exactly.
Right,
because anytime you get a puppy, the puppy pees in the on the floor a lot in like a very particular part of your house. So you can sometimes find spots you missed by shining UV light.
Or that trunk, or that trunk of the car where we got rid of the body. Whoopsie.
Yeah, that's true. It doesn't do a very good job of discriminating the type of fluid that was left.
Final word: there's no data yet on any of these products or any frequency of UV light against SARS-CoV-2. So that's too early for that. So we don't know.
Right.
If this will help. All right, Bob, tell me about this new Diamond Energy Storage. What's that all about?
Yeah, so dense energy storage was in the news this week, but it's not about conventional chemical batteries like lithium ion. It's about mechanical energy storage using a new type of material called DNT, or diamond nanothreads. This is from researchers at QUT, or the Queensland University of Technology Center for Material Science. This is based on their recent experimental results and first principle calculations. They think DNT can surpass lithium ion batteries in energy density and also be used for many, many other applications. So this story kind of starts with this whole idea of carbon nanotubes, CNT. We've talked about that on the show. It's been in the news for many, many years, right? We've all heard of those. And the carbon nanotubes are essentially allotropes of carbon, right? That means that it's a regular old carbon atom, but in a new type of arrangement or configuration that gives it different properties. That's opposed to a chemical isotope, which is different. That's an element that has an equal number of protons, but a different number of neutrons in their nuclei. So a big difference there. So to visualize a carbon nanotube, imagine a straw. Imagine you got chicken wire and you're going to make a straw because it's hollow in the middle. There's nothing in there. That's kind of like what a carbon nanotube is. Super, super tiny in the nanometer realm. We're talking a billionth of a meter, really, really small. If you're going to use them, you're not going to use one little tiny little fiber. You're going to use or thread. You're going to bundle them together in fibers or bundles. And this has long been considered a wonder material like flubber, right? Remember flubber? But instead of bouncing like crazy, CNTs are essentially what they call like these multifunctional nanotextiles. Incredible properties. No matter how you look at it, mechanical, chemical, physical, they're all off the hook. Very, very promising and far superior to traditional carbon or even polymetric fibers. Seems much, much better. But sometimes, though, the mechanical properties were hard to control for carbon nanotubes. Sometimes they would flatten and you'd have properties that were kind of like all over the place. You weren't sure what to expect for some of those important properties. So that led relatively recently to DNT, or these diamond nanothreads. And that's essentially a new type of super thin, one-dimensional carbon nanostructures. They're similar very, very thin carbon nanotubes, but denser, more akin to diamond, which is where they get their name. But another key difference, though, is the surface. The surface is treated differently so that the different threads interlock, but still maintain those thread-like shapes and the amazing mechanical properties that they've discovered, including this high mechanical energy storage density. So Dr. Hafezan's team found the bundle of nanothreads has an energy density, which is basically a measure of how much energy it could store for its mass, was 1.76 megajoules per kilogram. And now that does, that's just a number I'm throwing at you, but that's 4 to 5 orders of magnitude higher than a steel spring and up to 300% greater than lithium ion batteries. So that's a big improvement. 3 times better. Now, if you're trying to figure out how how are you going to actually extract energy from this? Dr. Zahn had a decent analogy. He said, similar to a compressed coil or children's wind-up toy, energy can be released as the twisted bundle unravels. So that's a good way to kind of envision what's going on at this nanoscale. So why even choose mechanical storage over chemical storage? I mean, what's the advantage, you know, besides just the energy density? Why? What's cool about it? Well, one big advantage is really just pure safety. Think about it. You got chemical storage like lithium-ion batteries. They use electrochemical reactions to hold on to and release the energy, right? But at high temperatures, and we've all heard stories about this, at high temperatures, they can explode. You know, phones have exploded. Laptops have exploded. I don't want those things exploding. That's pretty nasty. And even at low temperatures, they can just stop functioning. And then another problem with those kinds of things are that when they fail, they could leak. And you got this weird chemical leaking all over the place. So mechanical energy storage systems like DNT don't have those risks. And it can make them an ideal power source for some applications. And these are applications that we're going to see increasingly in the future, namely using them as a power source within the human body. I mean, we already have electronics in the body like pacemakers that need batteries. So, you know, these things need to be powered. I wouldn't want a regular battery inside of me. But biomedical devices that are implanted are just one potential use of DNT. Anything at all that could use a microscale power supply could benefit. Tiny robotics, electronics are two big, huge examples. But also, they're talking about things like power transmission lines, aerospace electronics. That's huge because they're so small and so powerful, that's exactly what you want for aerospace applications, because you need something that's super light, because you could save tons and tons of money. It's like what? It's still like what? 10,000 pounds, $10,000 per pound to put something in orbit? Just crazy, crazy numbers. But you could also use them for intelligent textiles, structural composites, like building materials. The potential applications are just vast. So DNTs, to me, certainly look very promising, even more so in some applications than the performance seems better than carbon nanotubes. But keep in mind, this research was based on a lot of what they call in silico studies that's done in the computer and in simulation. And sure, you know, these simulations are based on theories and solid mathematics, but still, there's no replacement yet anyway to actually building the actual devices that this research says is so promising. As usual, we're going to have to wait and see, but still, I'm pretty excited about this, and it's not just because nano is in its name. I think even if it had a different name, I think this would look very promising and really cool. So keep an eye on it.
But to be clear, no one's built one of these things yet.
Nope, that's the next step is to actually power these, you know, to control the power that goes in and the energy that comes out.
I'm a little fuzzy on just exactly how you translate the mechanical energy into electrical energy. You know what I mean? Do you have to couple it with something that's going to make that conversion?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the next big step. That's the next big challenge for them. And that's something that they're going to be working on. This is mainly, you know, based on their simulations and the math and some experiments, basically what they have come away with is that this material is ideal for these types of fiber applications, these bundles of fiber applications that they wanted to do with carbon nanotubes. It's really an amazing material to, you know, for these applications. So the next step is, all right, let's try to get all the things that would go now around it in order to actually use it as some sort of energy storage device. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're going to, and I mean, they don't see any, you know, major, you know, hurdles. Of course, it's going to be pretty damn complicated, but it's not like something like, you know, fusion level complication. This is something that I don't think is going to be too, you know, amazingly, horrifically difficult. But hey, yeah, who knows? We'll see.
Famous last words.
Yeah, right. But that's the next step anyway.
All right. So a couple more questions. Any data on charge-discharge cycles?
Nope. Didn't come across anything like that in my research. It's just like,
there's so many potential deal breakers.
Yeah, right.
Any kind
Tell
of
me
energy
about
storage
it.
System. And then the other thing is,
right,
you say three times the energy density, but if you then include the converter, the power converter,
happens?
Right? You have to go to Tashi Station, right, Jane?
Yeah. The
power
converter. didn't let me do it, huh, you bastard?
What does that do to the energy density if you include that component of it? You know, does that just wipe away all the advantages that you get?
Yep. I don't know at this point. I'll get back to you maybe in a few years when they come back with more research. But all these things where this stuff can fall to its knees. So, yep, absolutely. So I try not to get too excited, especially when it comes to to battery storage because I've just
read cool concept
every month. Like, yeah. Oh, look, another battery breakthrough. Yeah, I'm gonna
every
wait.
Day, every day.
Right.
Yep.
You know, I'm going through my news items for science or fiction. I come across at least 3 or 4 battery and solar cell news item every time.
Yeah,
but it's remarkable. Encouraging because it means that so many companies are working on this stuff.
And oh yeah,
you know, I love that.
Yeah, and that's what. Yeah, that's true, Jade. But it's not very often where we come across something that's completely new. I mean, it's not even chemical storage. This is like mechanical storage, which is interesting. And like I said, there's so many benefits, especially with the safety. You know, if I'm going to put something like that inside of me, I'd rather it be mechanical storage than chemical.
Right, but as we say, so many potential deal breakers until you have an actual application.
Absolutely.
You never
no disagreement
know.
Here.
Never know. All right, Evan, finish us off with a happy news item about reproducing cactus coral.
Yeah, very cool one that just came out today. Now, Carrie, you had some bad news the other week about our planet's coral reefs, specifically the Great Barrier Reef of Northern Australia. That was a very, very sad news item.
It was.
It's dying. It's dying. Well, to counter that, a bit of good news about coral reefs.
Good news, everyone.
We have the Florida Aquarium, which is in Tampa, Florida. And they announced today that they've made a breakthrough discovery, one that could eventually save our planet's dying coral reefs. Let's hope. They successfully reproduced ridged cactus coral for the first time in human care. They used some rescue coral. This was coral rescued by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission and the NOAA Fisheries. They're hoping to learn more about coral reproduction, the ultimate goal being the replenishment of the cactus coral reefs in Florida, which have experienced a disease outbreak since 2014. Now, these scientists are caring for the rescued adult coral colonies to breed and reproduce them in hopes of someday restoring the reefs, especially once the disease has finally gone. Now, with today's announcement, we know that these wonderful scientists have learned for the first time about when ridged cactus coral reproduce and what their babies look like. Whoever thought of like baby coral?
I know.
I think that could become a song, like that shark song, right?
Oh, God, don't get that in my head.
Baby coral, coral, baby coral.
This is new to the researchers. They didn't have much information about this particular coral's reproduction. There were no photos. There were no videos that had existed before this particular study. But now they have it. And just this month, it's been amazing, amazing results. Quickly about the ridged cactus corals. They are a brooding coral, which means they reproduce. What they do is they send out the sperm. Sperm goes out, not the eggs. The eggs stay with the coral itself. But the sperm gets released into the water, right? And the eggs are then fertilized. And the larva development occurs inside the parent coral, which is sweet. Then the parent coral spits out the larva. You're done here. You go. Find a place to live. And the larvae, they swim until they find a nice little resting place, and they settle down, and then they grow. So they say that the next steps will involve learning how far the larvae travel, and they say it's important because knowing how far they travel will shed light on how mixed the coral reef populations really are. The scientists told the news agencies, I saw an article at CNN about this, that they began giving birth or witnessing this birth in early April. That's just two weeks ago. And so far, 350 larvae have been witnessed in just a couple weeks. So that's really, really cool.
Oh, wow.
And it's all part of, you know, restoring what's called America's Great Barrier Reef.
America.
Yep, which is at the southern tip of Florida, on the starting in the Atlantic coast on those three counties like Dade and Broward and Palm Beach, basically extending down and through the entire Keys, all the way out to Key West. So that is our Great Barrier Reef, as it were. And I believe it's the third largest reef bed on the planet. But we don't, you know, it's dwarfed in comparison to the actual Great Barrier Reef out our friends in Australia. This is a nice step. And if it turns out, you know, we learn much more about this, we can try to save coral all over the place, hopefully, through what they're learning here.
Yeah. And again, the idea is just simply to breed mm-hmm. the coral and then plant them in the
wild.
That's
right. And yep.
That's the idea. Is that simple?
Right. Simple idea, but, you know, let's see what it takes. I mean, I imagine there are predators eating that larva as well. So, I mean, you would have to produce an awful lot.
Yeah, that's cool. We'll see how that pans out, exactly. Though.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Guys, last week I played this noisy. Okay, so you heard mm-hmm. four distinct sounds.
Mm-hmm.
You may or may not have heard these types of sounds before.
Mm-hmm. Some may have heard them more often than others.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. But there's something different about these that you might not know. All right. So apparently you guys have no idea.
So are they what they sound like?
Let's turn it over to the people who listen to this show and see what they think. So Tara yes. Fan.
All right.
Tara Fan wrote and said, "Hi, I'm a longtime listener, first time guesser. The Who's That Noisy this week is what happens when you ask Alexa, can you fart? And she presents you with a wide variety of farts. Both the type of fart and the playing match sound.
I've tested that.
Another listener, that's not correct. Mostly.
There's
partly,
not Alexa
partly.
Farting.
It's Siri.
Visto Tutti, my Roman warrior, has written in.
Yeah.
And he said, this week's noisy is a farting fish communication. Yes, like eight-year-old boys, some species of fish communicate using flatulence. The herring fish is renowned for this style of communication to aid in maintaining the shoal's cohesive structure and hierarchy.
Really?
Yes.
Jay, that's awesome. Jay, did you see the movie Treasure Planet?
Yes.
In that movie, mm-hmm. if you remember, which is cool because it was like a Pirates in Space, which of course I loved. But in that movie, there was an alien that communicated by like fart-like sounds. And one of the characters, you know, nobody could communicate with him. And one guy's like, I can talk with him. I speak flatula.
Flatula.
I love that line.
I was thinking about like a gun, like a fart gun called the flatulator.
I got one for your son.
Thank you.
And
I did.
And if he ever doesn't want it, I want it back.
Yes.
Are you kidding? It sits on Jay's desk. It has its own, it has its own mount.
I've installed it, Evan.
With a plaque.
It's installed
another
internally.
Another listener named Evil Eye. This is a...
Evil Eye.
Yeah, he's a very long-term listener of the show.
That guy's got whiskers on him.
I look at him on Facebook quite a bit because he comes up with funny stuff and he seems like a really good guy. He's definitely a long-time listener. He said, I hear something that can happen on the radio quite often and it sounds like farts, but is usually the host moving the microphone boom to adjust the arm to their face or the office chair moving. And my response is, that's what Steve wants you to believe, yes. But that is also not correct.
Got a little chuckle out of Steve there.
I have two winners this week because people wrote in at almost the same exact time with the correct answer. First person is Chance Duncan, and he said, Hi, J-Bob. This week's Who's That Noisy sounds like Elon Musk's attempt at providing some, let's say, lowbrow humor. All right, so what is this? The second person that wrote in, his name is Eric Harris. He had a very good explanation. He said, I recognize this week's noisy. It's Tesla's emissions testing mode. They put into their Model 3 cars in late 2018 and later incorporated into the Model S and X. It's a silly gimmick, but my wife insists that it's one of her favorite things about the car. You can pinpoint the fart sound to whichever seat in the car you want, and you could either have it pick a random noise or choose from a selection.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah,
it's so like a whoopee cushion mode.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
So the guy who sent this in, Michael Bukowski, said there's a boring fart, a what is this, a neurostink, ludicrous fart, falcon heavy, and short shorts ripper.
Falcon heavy.
So I'm not going to replay those because I can tell Steve wants me to move on. So I have another. I thought it was funny, Steve. Come on. It's a car and it makes fart noises.
It's a car farting. Got it.
I am giving...
You own one, Steve?
Well, isn't the German word to travel
said you got
fart,
it.
Or that's what conjugate of the verb to travel?
Oh, like
fart.
F-A-H?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
When you say car and fart, that's kind of they go together.
So I remember when I was in Vienna, a German book that was popular at the time was on all the bookstores and the airports and everything was something like Der Überfahrt. Some German listener could translate that for me. I think it was like the crossroads or something like that. I tried to figure out what that meant. But just to an American saying Überfahrt, it was got to our 15-year-old selves, yes. Right, Kara? That was very, very humorous.
Look, I'll cross that line here and say, farts are funny even when you're an adult, okay?
That's agree.
It. Just funny. All right, so.
How do you know, Jay?
Moving on. Moving on, Steve. Now, I'm giving my listeners a fair warning. This is one of those loud and irritating noises. So I'm going to count to five and give you a chance to quickly lower the volume, pause, do what you got to do. This one is not nice. Ready?
Uh-oh.
I mean, what is that? What the heck is it?
I don't know.
That was sent in by a listener named Rob Arbin. Yeah, so you hear some voices in the background there. I'm not talking about the noise, the voices. Forget about those. It's just the noise that you hear. I'd like to know. You can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org, of course, with any suggestions for noises. And if you have some good guesses, or if you'd like to tell me just how you're doing out there. How are you doing, SGU listeners? You holding up okay?
Well, Jay, we can mention that every Friday at 5 o'clock Eastern
Daylight Time,
we are doing like a typically like an hour and a half long stream open to the public. It's kind of like a second episode of the SGU, but live. We do talk about current events, news items, and then
the bulk is answering
questions. So we will be doing that just every Friday at 5 o'clock Eastern Standard Time until further notice. So how do you get to that, Jay? Facebook, YouTube, our homepage?
You could just go to theskepticsguide.org and we'll have a link for it on our homepage in the upper navigation. We'll put something pretty obvious for you. Yeah, we love doing it. It's fun. It lasts about an hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes. You know, we also veer off topic and you can look into our private offices and things like that. And we also just really appreciate anybody that shows up. We had over 1,000 people that came last week. It'd be a lot of fun.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. That's awesome. It's going good. Yeah. Nice. I mean, I don't know what the total numbers are. I know that at any given time when I checked, we're averaging over 1,000, which is great.
That's awesome. That's really great.
And the people that are watching are having a lot of fun talking to each other. The banter is actually, I was reading back on some of it, and it's really funny.
It is fun. It's fun to read back, yeah.
Now, Evan, talking about fun, because I know you like to have fun.
I do.
There is something called Nexus. That is the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. We've been doing this for a very long time, 12, 13 years?
Yep.
This year, because of COVID-19, we bring to you a very special episode of Nexus 2020, which is called Nexus 2020 Live Stream. We are live streaming the conference, and we would love for you to go to nexus.org, N-E-C-S-S.org. To sign up, for all the details are there. We also have announced that we will be having an in-person conference in 2021 in Atlantic City. We are still, of course, working on the details on that because it's so far in the future. But that conference and the digital conference happening on August 1st are going to be quite different than other conferences we've had. We've shaken up the entire idea of what a conference is, and we wanted to try different formats to see what works best. And I'm telling you that from the last meeting that we had, the executive committee meeting that we had for Nexus, we have some really cool ideas that I can't wait for the day now. So I'm really excited. We'll be announcing speakers very soon and any more details that are relevant that you need to know. But right now you can sign up on necss.org. And if you do sign up, you will also be helping us fund the 2021 conference. So please do consider joining us. What I recommend is that you grab a couple of friends, you buy an entrance to it, you grab some snacks, maybe some lunch and some drinks, and you sit there together and enjoy the conference together.
If you're allowed to by then.
Right. Yeah, we better be. by August 1st, please. Oh my God.
Either that or everyone is siloed in their own, you know, containing bubble.
You can also have like a Skype window or a Google Hangouts or something like that window open. So you can be like watching the conference and engaging, but also like talking to your friends. Be fun.
Nice.
Yep. Cool. And we're going to have a VR space too. So you could basically enjoy the entire conference from within a virtual space. like our plan is to have the conference like displayed on a monitor within the virtual space, and you could walk up to it and listen to it, or you could walk away and talk to other people or whatever. We'll see how it works out, but that's our plan for now.
Pretty cool.
All right, one quick email. This one comes from Kyle Hall from Erie, Pennsylvania. Isn't there a song about Erie, Pennsylvania?
There's a TV show about it. Do you guys remember? It's like a horror show or something.
All right, so he says, should we be worrying about false negatives for coronavirus testing? I've been seeing claims on Facebook where people state that COVID-19 testing is, quote unquote, 30% inaccurate, is just a placebo, and that we should not even bother with it. No citations, of course, but I think they are referencing this article. Let me give us a link. I'd love to hear a more in-depth analysis of the subject. So when you're talking about a test, calling it like such and such percent accurate or such and such percent inaccurate is not really a technical way of describing the test. I know we've spoken about this before on the show, but I'm going to tell you again because this is now very relevant as we're talking about we need testing. If we're going to transition, you know, from the sort of universal physical distancing to targeted distancing, that requires testing. And so that's why there's information like this spreading around, like, well, how, quote unquote, accurate are the tests? So scientists, medical professionals don't talk about how accurate a test is. We talk about sensitivity and specificity, right? The sensitivity is basically the percentage of people who have the disease who test positive. And the specificity is the percentage of people who test positive who have the disease. So a highly sensitive test will pick up more people who have the disease. A specific test means that if you test positive, you're more likely to have the disease. Although that's not strictly true either, because in order to really interpret the predictive value of a test, you need to know not only the sensitivity and the specificity, but what else do you need, Evan? What else do you need to know?
Specificity.
Representativeness, heuristic. What do you need? You need to know.
You need to know the thing you're about to say. The
anyone? What's critical? If I tell you a 40-year-old woman had a positive mammogram, mm-hmm. And it's 90% sensitive and 90% specific, what's the probability that she has breast cancer?
Is it 90% of 90%?
The answer is you don't know. With the information I gave you, what is not the information enough. You're missing? The information
how
you're
many
missing
people
is
took the test?
No,
90% of what?
It's not. Yeah, it's not how many people took the test. It's what's the base rate?
Oh, I see. Okay,
what
yeah.
is the pretest probability? Right? How many 40-year-old women have breast cancer? Mm. That's what you need to know. So,
but we don't know that with COVID.
Well, we don't know that. You're right. But also, it will be different based upon which subpopulation you test.
Yeah.
So, are you testing just people who are symptomatic, or are you testing everybody? And that dramatically affects the predictive value,
sure.
the number of false positives and false negatives. So if you're testing only a population of people who really probably have it, then your false negative rate becomes more significant, right? Because there's more potential for there to be a false negative test. There's more people who are actually positive. If you're testing a population that very likely doesn't have it, then your false positive rate becomes more of a problem because then the potential for false positives is greater because there's more people who are actually negative. Does that make sense? And so if you're saying like with a test with this sensitivity and this specificity, if you test positive, what's the probability you have the disease? The answer is it depends. It depends on what population and what the pretest probability is, what percentage of that population actually has the thing you're testing for.
But the problem here is that we don't have that absolute number.
We don't. I mean, we'll have to try to figure out as best as we can from doing studies on subsets of people with definitive testing, as definitive as possible.
Yeah, like,
and then trying to extrapolate to the general population.
Like maybe the same group of people have been tested using 5 different tests.
Or we know clinically 100% that they have it. You know what I
yeah,
mean?
But we're never going to know that clinically, right? Because
or you do a biopsy or whatever.
Because like, the problem with this is that you can have it asymptomatically. That's the whole point of needing these tests.
Yeah, but the point is you can still test it in people that you know have it so that you at least know what the base rate is.
Yeah.
And then you can from that try to extrapolate. But you're right. The hard thing is knowing for sure that somebody doesn't have it. Mm-hmm. To put them into that category, because then how do you know they're not just a false negative of whatever test you're using? So that's where the quote unquote gold standard comes in. So you have to figure out, you use whatever the gold standard test is, no matter how expensive, invasive, difficult it is. You just want to get a population of people where we know as much as we possibly can who does and who does not have disease X. Mm-hmm. And then we can compare that against any new test that we want to use, the cheap, easy, quick test, to see how sensitive and specific it is. So, okay, so saying 30% inaccurate doesn't really give us a good idea of like what the false negative rate would be. What they said was that it was 70% sensitive. And so that's where they got that 30% inaccurate from. But that, again, you can't say that 30% of the tests are going to be false negative,
right,
until you know what population you're testing and what the probability is. It actually could be higher or lower depending on how many people have the disease. But here's the other thing, is that 70% is not accurate. So I looked it up independently, and the tests that are out there are already like 95% sensitive.
Oh, okay.
So,
really?
That's good.
Yeah.
And when you say the tests that are out there, I mean,
like if you're getting the current swab test, you know, like they stick the thing all the way up your nose, that people are getting right now, that's in the 90 plus 93, 95, whatever percent sensitive. So that's pretty good. That's, you know, 93%, you know, again, still like if you're testing, depending on the population you're testing, that could still be a lot of false negatives.
And that's for active infection. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's for active infection. That's you have the virus reproducing in your nasal passage, not you have antibodies because you were exposed a month ago. That's a different test. All right, but the bottom line of all this is the testing doesn't do the heavy lifting for you. And this is, again, something we have to really beat into medical students. And I always use medical students as my barometer, meaning that medical students start out as the lay public and they get beaten into physicians, right? Into clinicians, metaphorically speaking, of course. They go through the trial of fire and they come out the other end. They are forged in the fire of medical, whatever. What I mean by that is you take the naive assumptions that the general public makes, and we say, no, this is how it actually works. So how it actually works is you have to put a test, any kind of laboratory test that you're doing, into the context of the clinical situation. And that means clinically, how suspicious are you that person has the disease you're testing for? Epidemiologically, what is the base rate for that person of that age, gender, social situation, exposure, whatever, their risk factors? You take all their risk factors, say, all right, this is how likely they are to have it before we do the test. Now we're going to do the test with, it has a certain sensitivity and specificity. We get the result. Now we have a different number of how likely they are to have it after the test. But it's not 100% or 0%, and it never is.
Yeah, it's just another piece of evidence.
It's another piece of evidence that you have to put into clinical context. And at the end of the day, a really strong clinical picture trumps the test.
Yeah.
If somebody clinically has COVID-19, we're like, damn, this is COVID-19, and the test is negative, it's not like we're not going to treat them. You know what I mean? And you don't just say, well, the test is negative, so I guess I'll throw out all my clinical, you know, intuition out the window. It doesn't work that way because nothing is 100%.
And it's especially the case, right, Steve, with a disease like this where we don't even have a treatment. Like we just know what to do for like supportive care.
Yeah, I mean, it may not matter in terms of like if the treatment does not alter based on the test results. But then, of course, we say, well, then why are you doing the test? So
testing now for epidemiological purposes more than anything.
Well, that's we're just gathering data, so that's different. But if you're talking about patient care, and again, this is also that question for medical students, you want to do this test. How is it going to affect your management? If you can't answer that question, you don't do the test.
Right.
Or you need to figure out how it is going to answer that question. Now, the answer may be this will affect our guidelines in terms of isolation. We're going to isolate people who test positive and not isolate people who test negative.
Or if
that's reasonable.
Or if there's a treatment that's like actually very dangerous to give, like it's, you want to kind of be pretty sure that they need it because otherwise it could like affect their liver or their kidneys.
Yeah, exactly. So it might affect your treatment decision, you know, or sometimes it's just prognosis, and that's, you know, that may be enough of a reason to do it. And then, you know, when we're in the, either at academic centers or when we're in the discovery phase of a new illness, we may do it just to gather data so that we know what the hell is going on. But the idea is with COVID-19 and with trying to have testing available, and I've heard some experts say, we need to be doing 5 million tests a day.
Yeah, you know, they're basically saying we have to test the whole population.
Well, yeah, in order to like really, really be able to go work our way through the population so we know who can and cannot go out there in the world, you know, to relax things. But again, when that kind of massive testing, then like the false positive, false negative rate becomes really important. Again, more the false positive rate, though, than the false negative rate. Mm-hmm. When you're testing, when you're doing general screening of a broad population where most people don't have the disease, the false positives could easily become greater than the true positives, even when you have like 90%+ specificity. It depends.
Well, that was
good
quick
and timely question.
Quick email.
Yeah, that was the quick version.
Next week, the long one.
Yeah. Now, the long one is go to medical school. That's it. All right, guys, it's time for science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. 3 just random news items this week, no theme. Are you guys ready?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
All right, here we go. I think these are all rather interesting. Item number 1. Scientists have concluded that heavy rainfall triggered the Kilauea volcano eruption in May 2018. Item number 2, a new study finds that drones are more energy efficient than diesel delivery vans in urban settings. And item number 3, researchers find that drinking coffee, regular or decaffeinated, over the short term significantly increases sensitivity to sweetness and decreases sensitivity to bitterness. Kara, why don't you go first?
Anecdotally, I'd say okay with the coffee one. Could be the case, because I think that the more you, like, sometimes people will say coffee is an acquired taste, and that could be in some ways what they mean, right? Because coffee is very bitter, you know, that's why people add milk and sugar when they want to, and some people like it black and blah blah blah, but the more you drink it, I think the less sugar you might need in the long term, or the less milk you might need in the long term.
I disagree.
But generally speaking, I probably have a better coffee tolerance, if that makes sense. And I do still have a sweet tooth, and maybe my sweet tooth is worse because I drink coffee. I don't know. It just doesn't seem that far-fetched to me. Heavy rainfall triggering a volcano eruption. I mean, volcanoes are, you know, a type of kind of seismically active situation. But I could see there being some sort of mechanical or physical situation that would induce a volcano. And then drones are more energy efficient than diesel delivery vans in urban settings. And can I ask, Steve, I mean, you might not be able to tell me, but is that within some sort of weight parameter, or is that just across the board?
They didn't put any limits on it. So I think it's just, they modeled, you know, I guess typical package delivery. So they didn't give any weight parameters.
Okay. So, but it is like package delivery. It's not just like letters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's package delivery.
So if it were just like very light things, I might say, yes, that's true. But it seems like it's between the volcano and the drones. I'm actually going to say that the fiction is the drones.
Okay, Evan.
Oh boy. So heavy rainfall triggering the Kilauea volcano eruption. Okay. Well, all I can think about is when I see lava pouring into the ocean, it causes a lot of steam and this glass and stuff that forms and, you know, real nasty toxic vapors and things. So, but that's kind of an opposite effect of what's going on here. But nasty stuff can occur when you add lots of water to something volcanic going on. So there may be, I don't know if that's some kind of direct connection, but I kind of have a feeling that this one's going to turn out to be science. New study finds that drones are more energy efficient than diesel delivery vans now in urban settings. Oh my gosh, I can go on and on about drones.
Steve's like, but you're not going to.
You can drone on about drones.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you for clarifying Hi-yo. That for those who needed the clarification. Well, okay, so what you're talking about here, I imagine a drone can carry one package at a time, I think, or maybe a few small things at a time, as opposed to one nice big diesel delivery van in the urban settings, which is the city, which is making, delivering potentially hundreds of boxes over the course of a city block. So I don't know if that one's going to hold up. I don't know if the math works out there. It's just kind of a matter of those ratios. If you know the ratios, you know the answer here. So I don't know about that one. And then drinking coffee, which I do not do. I am not a coffee drinker. If this one's the fiction, then it's going to either significantly increase, but the opposite would be significantly decrease. Could it significantly decrease? You know, flip-flop the two. Decrease sensitivity to bitterness means increase sensitivity to bitterness, if this were the fiction. But I think I'll go with Kara. I'm going to the drone something with the drones and the vans. I don't think the math is adding up there. I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see. The heavy rainfall triggering the Kilauea. Yeah, it can't make a tremendous amount of sense out of that. Although I think this whole steam production, and there are some islands just get so much rain. It's insane. Like the highest rainfall
in the planet.
Yeah, it's crazy. So maybe I could see that. So the drinking coffee one, that just makes sense that over the short term there would be a, you know, you're getting hit with this bitterness, assuming you're not, I guess, throwing in a lot of sugar. But I could see how that would kind of work. So by elimination, I think that one's going to be the fiction. There's something wacky about that. I'll say that's fiction as well.
Okay, and Jay.
So I'll click right over to the drones thing. I've done a little bit of reading about this, and What I know is that drones are not good for heavy packages. Right. I don't know if that has anything to do with this news item. But I would imagine, though, the real question here is when you say more efficient, you know, again, we're just saying raw energy. What takes more energy? And I know that it's incredibly not energy efficient to put something up in the air. And that's the one thing about that news item I don't like is that. But then I question it. Why would they do it then? Why would they use drones if it wasn't going to be some type of savings? So I'm not sure. The rainfall one with the volcano, I have no problem with that. I can see, you know, rainfall causing erosion making lower the amount of material that's on top of a node or nodule that's coming up. Yeah, so, okay, that one's fine. And then this one about drinking coffee. I am a regular coffee drinker. I absolutely know that when you exercise your palate, it reacts. So that one does make a lot of sense. So just from those two things, I would want to go with number two. But there's details about number two that if it is the fiction, I'm gonna want clarification from Steve. All right, I'll go with the group. Go GWG.
All right, so you guys are all in agreement. So we'll take these in order.
Oh, we're gonna call that going with Kara, by the way.
Yeah, how about going with Kara this week?
Oh, you really want to say that?
Proudly. I mean, at this point, you asked me to put my nickel down, so.
All right. Item number one, scientists have concluded that heavy rainfall triggered the Kilauea volcanic eruption in May 2018. You guys all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Nice.
Yeah, so that I don't think any of you hit upon the key, though, which is that the water
steam
basically softens the rock.
Oh, nice.
So it makes it more likely for the magma underneath to break through.
Oh, interesting.
It's just all about pressure. You know, is there enough pressure to break through? The water loosens it up enough that it was able to break through. It's just that simple.
Water.
So that's based on models, cool. You know, et cetera. But that's they had a massive amount of rain. So, you know.
Wait, models are doing science reporting now?
Yep, that's right. All right, let's go to number two. A new study finds that drones are more energy efficient than diesel delivery vans in urban settings. You guys all think this one is the fiction. So the question is, remember we had that news item about flying cars, you know, like drone-like cars could be more efficient in an urban setting because they could bypass things like traffic and blah, blah, blah. Does the same thing apply to drones delivering packages?
Yeah, it's a time savings. it's a huge component, right?
Right, right. So how does it, how do all those variables work out?
Yeah.
Well, this one is the fiction.
Yes.
Yeah. So you guys got it. And
thanks, Kara.
In terms of the reason that this is the fiction, Evan actually gave the most complete answer. Evan, you were exactly correct.
Whoa.
Is that because it can only carry one or two at a time?
One at a time.
Yeah.
So the drones deliver one package at a time, whereas a delivery van could stop in an urban setting, could stop in one location and then deliver a whole bunch of packages to a whole bunch of people. Mm. And so it's particularly in an urban setting. So they tested diesel vans, electric vans, and then the electric drones. The most efficient was the electric vans. They were 10 times as efficient as drones.
Wow.
Tent, it wasn't even close. Diesels were still a lot better than the drones, but they weren't quite as energy efficient as the electric vans were.
What about fusion vans?
In a rural setting,
different.
The drones could be more efficient, right?
Because they're
making a single delivery of a single package, the drone could be more efficient than driving a whole big van out there to drop off one package.
Yeah.
But it's the multiple deliveries that makes the, in an urban setting, that makes the van, the delivery van, more energy efficient.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, so good job with that, Evan. You hit upon
thanks.
It.
And also good job, Kara, because I was right.
Yes. Good job, everybody.
You blazed the trail. You blazed the trail.
You did that. All right. All of this means that researchers find that drinking coffee, regular or decaffeinated, because they did test both, over the short term, this is not a long-term effect, Kara, significantly increases sensitivity to sweetness and decreases sensitivity to bitterness. So what they did in this study was they simply had subjects eat something and rate its sweetness or bitterness. And then they had them drink coffee, and they had an internal control, right? So they were testing them against themselves and then rate sweetness and bitterness. And they rated things more sweet and less bitter after drinking coffee. They repeated it with decaffeinated to make sure it wasn't the caffeine itself, and that was the results were the same, so it's not the caffeine. This is a short-term study only.
It's like the actual flavor of the coffee that's doing that?
It's something in the coffee molecule, yeah. You know, the substances that are in the coffee that are doing it. And they tested this for a very specific reason, because they suspected that the perception of, and this had no effect on smell, by the way. This was not an olfactory effect. It was purely taste, not smell. Their concern was that when we test, we do taste tests, like scientific taste tests, that you have to carefully control for whatever the person had before the test, because that may up or down regulate their perception.
We didn't do that at Nexus last year. Ooh.
No, we didn't.
During our taste test, we didn't cleanse our palates.
That's right. That's why you have to cleanse your palate. So they said that they wanted to test it with coffee. And so it may be true that when you're drinking coffee, you know, apparently people like to eat dark chocolate with coffee, and which is sort of less sweet and more bitter than milk chocolate, but it might make sense because the coffee makes it taste sweeter, relatively speaking, and less bitter.
Interesting.
It is interesting.
I
wonder, what do you drink or eat to clear your palate?
Like, water.
What's the best way? Just water, you think?
Milk.
Because I know the funny thing is
whiskey.
People use coffee beans
whiskey.
Yeah. To clear your scent palate. Like if you're shopping for a perfume, you might smell coffee beans in between each of the perfume samples. So that you're getting like a fresh smell.
In Chinese restaurants, they give you orange wedges or orange slices.
Right. Yeah, you're right.
Kara, the only time I encountered using coffee as a olfactory, quote-unquote, palate cleanser was in the morgue.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when we had to do autopsies on people who were ripe.
I see. So more it was just to mask the odor.
Yeah, just masking. To bring out cans of coffee grounds.
So they didn't use that
something to cover up the odor.
What's the stuff you wipe underneath your nose?
Yeah, you could do that too. Something that. Very, very, what is that? It's like a menthol kind of thing.
Yeah, like a eucalyptus or something. Yeah.
Why can't they just give you a whole body helmet or something, you know?
Yeah. I mean,
or send a robot in to do the autopsy or something.
That was bad.
Steve, is there ever a point when you're walking into a room full of corpses and you just turn around and go, F this. Like, nah.
Ask Bob. Don't ask Steve.
There was one time in my gross anatomy class where I had the cumulative heebie-jeebies.
You
like you spent an entire semester with your head in a corpse. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and it, at that point, it's just anatomy. Like you're not think like there's nothing horror story about it. It's just anatomy, you know? But then at one point, I'm like, holy crap, I'm in a room full of corpses. And I just got like this one wave of the chills, but I got over it very quickly. However, it did affect my dreams for years.
I mean, interesting.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's a film director, and she did a show that required a lot of forensic coverage, a documentary series. And she had to film in a lot of morgues and film in a lot of dead bodies. And she said it really dramatically affected her. Like, she's like, I won't go near a dead body for any projects for the foreseeable future. I just can't do it. It's just like too much. She said the smell is too much. It's mostly that the smell was too much, but she also said that, it invades your dreams at night.
Yeah.
Just being around it a lot. But I guess some people just don't have
You got to get over it. It's like, you know, half the reason I think that we do that in medical school. I mean, obviously, it's you're learning gross anatomy. That's the primary point. But it's part of the whole experience. I mean, you know, ideally, doctors need to be able to function fully without being emotionally affected, surrounded by gore and whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you can't be squeamish and be a doctor. And so that gets beaten out of you, again, to use that metaphor, in medical school. You know, basically it's exposure therapy. It's like any squeamishness you have will be gone by the end of your training.
And but you assume that like an undertaker or somebody who works in capacity around dead bodies all the time, you just get used to it.
There's just no effect. Yeah, there's just no effect after a while. All right, very cool area. So it was kind of a large segue there at the end there.
Yeah,
but Evan, give us a quote.
So I'll give you the quote, but do you remember when I was speaking about ridged cactus coral before?
Yeah.
I remember that. That was today.
You know what its official name is?
What?
It's Mycetophilia lamarckiana.
Lamarckism?
Lamarck! So this week's quote is going to be from Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. That's what inspired this quote. I looked it up. So,
the most unfairly treated person in the history of science, by the way.
You think so?
Totally agree. Yeah.
Wow.
Totally
agree. Yeah. Okay.
He treated like he was some sort of like pseudoscientific charlatan, but really
he was just great.
He's a great scientist.
Early. Yeah, he just had some ideas that some panned out, some didn't, actually.
And the idea that he is, that people attach to him, the passing on of acquired characteristics, wasn't even his.
Mm. Oh, my
God. It wasn't him.
There you go.
He got screwed.
Interesting.
Yeah, he got screwed. Go ahead.
He did get screwed. So, let's honor him with this quote. Induction, analogy, hypotheses founded upon facts and rectified continually by new observations. A happy tact given by nature and strengthened by numerous comparisons of its indications with experience. Such are the principal means for arriving at truth.
Oh. Yeah, and his career reflected that. You know,
yes.
He started out thinking that evolution was a progressive force, you know, leading quote-unquote upward, and he completely reversed himself based upon the evidence. He did experiments, looked at the fossil record and go, nope. It's not. It's just adaptation to local environment. That's it. That was the bulk of his career as an evolutionary scientist. He was correct, and he listened to the evidence over his preconceived notions changed his mind.
Hello.
Good for him.
Super good for him. And we should learn more about Lamarck in our science classes, our science history classes.
All right. Thank you, Evan.
Thanks, Steve.
And thank all of you for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
You got it, brother.
Thanks, doctor.
Got nothing better to do.
See you on Friday.
See you Friday.
Woohoo!
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.